This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to school to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million. Three little letters, almost 40% of the global economy, TPP, the Trans-Pacific Partnership. Here's five more letters for you, POTUS, President Obama, on global trade and the economy back home on the broadcast today. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. We're in Washington today. It is Tuesday, the 6th day of October. I'm Kai Ryssdal. It is great to have you here, everybody, here for the purposes of the next six or so minutes of this program, being the Department of Agriculture building right on the National Mall in downtown Washington. An otherwise faceless and nameless government conference room, save for the guy who was sitting in the chair across from me this morning with the Trans-Pacific Partnership, that huge Asian trade deal he's been working on for years now. More specifically, the selling thereof. All that was firmly on his mind.
Mr. President, good to talk to you again, sir.
Great to talk to you, Kai.
On the theory that the TPP is a legacy thing for you, right, along with the Affordable Care Act and the stimulus program from what seems like a really long time ago now, how involved were you with this thing at the very end? Were you making phone calls? Were you working other leaders?
Yes. And the reason is not because it's a legacy item for me, because it's a legacy item for America. Keep in mind, Kai, that we started this 5 years ago with the basic proposition that the Asia-Pacific region is the most populous, fastest-growing region in the world. Mm-hmm. And since 95% of the world's markets outside our borders, we got to make sure that we're selling in other countries goods made in America and services designed and produced here in the United States. And so we gathered together these 11 countries. It was a very difficult, contentious negotiation. Our team did a great job. At the very end, you always have a few things that you just got to get over the hump. And so, yes, I made calls to prime ministers. I made calls to presidents. I made calls to U.S. businesses. I made calls to a lot of stakeholders, environmental groups, to explain to them why it is so important for us to make sure that we've got a high standard set of rules governing trade and commerce in this region, because if we don't set those standards, if we don't have strong labor standards, environmental standards, transparency, making sure that our companies are being treated fairly. If we don't set them, then China will set them, and our businesses and our workers will be disadvantaged. So we put a lot of effort into this thing. Now our goal is to make sure that everybody here in the United States is informed about it. We will be posting every dotted I and crossed T on a website, and Congress and the American public and all the constituencies that are interested are going to be able to review this thing and see that, in fact, this is the most progressive, high-standard trade deal ever crafted.
When are you going to post it? Soon?
Soon.
Okay. Seems to me a little bit like you're betting on the come on this one, right? Because as we've seen the past 4 months, the Chinese are not afraid to get their hands in there and mess around with their own economic gears, right? With currency manipulation, with trying to prop up their stock market. Currency manipulation, in fact, was a big point of contention between you and the Congress when you were negotiating fast track on this one. What do the Chinese have to do that will prove to you that they're going to do this? Because
Well, keep in mind, Kai, that if you look at the data, the peak of Chinese currency manipulation was taking place 10 years ago, 5 years ago, 15 years ago. Right now, actually, the most recent intervention they did in the markets mm-hmm. probably propped up the RMB, their currency. It probably be even lower had they not intervened.
But it scared the bejesus out of everybody.
Well, it did, and I think that it also concerned President Xi, recognizing that you can't, in a interconnected global economy, continue to operate at the scale they're operating with old rules that maybe applied when they were a backwater economy. Now they're a major player and a major engine of economic growth, and they've got to be more transparent, more professional, more in sync with best practices. That, I think, is going to help. When it comes to currency manipulation, one of the things that we have in the Trans-Pacific Partnership, and this is the first time we've been able to get all these countries to agree on it, there are a set of principles in terms of how you measure and what constitutes currency manipulation. Now, it is not an enforceable provision in the same way that, for example, violations of labor standards or environmental standards will be. But keep in mind that when it comes to setting up these trade rules internationally, our goal is constantly to raise the bar. And you're never going to get 100% of what you want right away.
Let's talk about the impact back home for a minute. I get that if I'm a big pharma or if I'm a dairy farmer in this country, this deal has immediate ramifications for me. But if I'm just some person out there in the regular economy, how am I going to see this? What's it going to mean to me?
You know, a lot of people say, oh, it's the big corporations that are all benefiting from this. Companies like a Boeing or a GE, they've got suppliers chains that go from Maine to California. They've got companies that may only have 50 employees that produce one particular part. You've got wine growers in Oregon. You've got tea producers, small internet companies and small businesses that are producing for export today, partly because it's powered by the internet. In fact, this trade agreement for the first time has an entire chapter just devoted to making sure that small businesses have access to these export markets, not just the big companies.
So that's the big economic view from the White House today, the big picture, rather. A bit later on in the broadcast, the TPP and what it means for you and for me. Also, we've got explainers on the TPP, what it is, exactly why you ought to care, and what China has to do with it. The rest of today's conversation is online. Also, you can compare and contrast what the president told me today with what he said to us about the TPP 4 months ago in the Oval Office. On Wall Street today, things were sort of betwixt and between. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. There is technology news today of note. Microsoft had a big product launch this morning, and while it might not have had the panache of an Apple unveiling or the gee whiz of Tesla's new car, there were nonetheless some surprises. Microsoft is making a laptop, its first one ever. It's sort of a cross between a laptop and a tablet. It's called the Surface Pro. Also, new smartphones that have been used like desktops. Marketplace's Nova Sappho has more now on exactly who these gadgets are meant for.
Certainly Microsoft would love it if we all stood in Apple-like lines for its latest gadgets, but at the least they're hoping businesses get excited. Here's how Microsoft CEO Satya Nadella described the latest smartphones.
We're building the most productive phone on the planet. Phones you can run entire business on.
Because they can dock with a keyboard and monitor and become a mini PC. That feature, combined with Windows 10, which works across devices, is Microsoft's attempt to turn around its fortunes in mobile.
It has been a major uphill battle for Microsoft for years.
Daniel Ives with FBR Capital Markets says Microsoft's phones have just not hit it big.
They're really a rounding error when it comes to overall market share.
Meanwhile, Microsoft's operating system is going strong. The company says 110 million devices have already downloaded Windows 10. And the mobile gadgets it unveiled today are designed to take advantage of that. Microsoft says users can seamlessly transition between them. Ramon Lamas is a mobile analyst with IDC.
If you're doing a Word document on your smartphone, and then later on you could pick it up again on your PC, and then later on your tablet, there's a sense of continuity there.
That may be compelling to businesses, Lamas says, but it could take a year or more for Microsoft to show progress.
This is going to be a slow sell. Okay, I don't think there's going to be a lot of people barging down the doors, you know, at day one saying, give me that right now.
After all, Lamas says, most of us, even businesses, have already picked our favorite mobile gadgets. I'm Nova Safo for Marketplace.
Should you be a football fan, you've no doubt seen the ads this season because, come on, they have been everywhere for the competing fantasy sports sites DraftKings and FanDuel. You pick real players, you play fantasy games using, and this is important, real money. Yesterday, the pair did something that rival companies don't usually do. They put out a joint statement defending themselves against accusations of insider betting and misuse of company data. Basically, it seems a DraftKings employee won hundreds of thousands of dollars playing on FanDuel. It is an episode that will only intensify calls for somebody to do something about it. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer has more.
One way to stop a play in sports. In the fantasy sports world, you turn to government regulation. People like Congressman Frank Pallone, a Democrat of New Jersey, he calls these fantasy sports sites the Wild West, completely unregulated.
So that if people place a bet, they don't even know that they're being treated fairly.
Gambling is now regulated by the states. Pallone says you could keep it that way.
Or if you thought that you wanted to have these sites continue as a nationally, then I guess you'd have to have something like an SEC type of situation.
The sites are now temporarily prohibiting their employees from playing for money. Rick Burton teaches sports management at Syracuse University. He says those employees should never have been allowed to play.
I assume that's probably like racetracks probably don't allow their employees to bet on the horses.
If these fantasy sites don't end up being regulated like, say, racetracks, players might just stay away. The market might do the regulator's job. According to Timothy Fong, co-director of the Gambling Studies Program at UCLA.
And if I'm playing daily fantasy sports and then I find out that I'm playing against potentially some insider who has insider information, I don't think I'm going to join.
Fong says people could go back to just playing informal fantasy games with friends. That's what he's doing, assembling a fantasy baseball team without any players from his favorite team, the Cubs.
Because of their 100-year tradition of losing and not doing well.
He may regret that. After all, the Cubs are in the playoffs this year. I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
Companies and businesses tinker with their core brand identities at their peril. Chief among those core attributes, of course, the name of the enterprise in question, be it corporate conglomerate or nonprofit alike. But sometimes, business being business, you got to do what you got to do, which is why some institutions of higher education are changing their names. You've got colleges becoming universities, other schools dropping or adding place names, all in the service of attracting more students and more donors. But it is a complex and often expensive process, as Bradley George reports from Georgia Public Broadcasting.
Want to know how difficult it can be to change the name of a college? Talk to Brooks Keel.
You think changing a name is simple? It's not simple at all.
He's the president of what is now Augusta University in Augusta, Georgia. But 3 years ago, it became Georgia Regents University when two state colleges merged. Students, alumni, and local residents hated that name.
A large crowd displayed and voiced their displeasure with the new U's new name, Georgia Regents University, at a protest on Augusta State's campus Monday.
There were protests, and a college in Virginia with a similar name sued. State officials changed course and last month rechristened Georgia Regents Augusta University. All of that sounds familiar to Tom Hayes. He teaches marketing at Xavier University in Cincinnati and co-founded a higher ed marketing firm.
We worked with a college that was switched the name just from a college to a university, which, you know, at the time, every piece of research said this is a great idea. And we got phone calls at our homes from people basically saying, you'll never work in this town again. You know, they were so upset about it.
In a YouTube Q&A, Augusta University President Keel says there's no timetable yet for rolling out everything from a new logo to updated web domains and athletic jerseys. But last time around, it cost nearly $4 million just to replace signs on campus. Keel says it will be worth the expense again. He's expecting disgruntled alumni and other stakeholders to come back into the fold with open wallets, because having Augusta in the name will make them feel more at home.
Because people feel more connected with their university. I think we're going to see a large uptick in fundraising across the board. We need to take advantage of the opportunities that this presents to us, and I think you're going to see a huge support from the community from that perspective.
Tom Hayes, the higher ed marketing expert, agrees. And he says the Augusta experience will be a cautionary tale for others, as the school will have to live with the aftermath of its earlier multi-million dollar mistake.
You can imagine transcripts, you know, someone, you know, that is looking for a job or, you know, as they move along in life and they're looking at the name of your university and that university name doesn't exist anymore.
The University of Missouri Rolla doesn't exist anymore. 8 years ago, it became the Missouri University of Science and Technology, or S&T for short. Andrew Carriega oversees marketing there. He admits the new name is a mouthful, but helps tell a story.
Well, a lot of the storytelling also depends on the audience, right?
Carriega says the school tested several different names, but the one that explained the school's focus was the most attractive to students.
So that kind of sealed the deal for us when we found out that that was a name that appealed to the prospective students that we were interviewing and talking to. We decided to move with Missouri S&T.
He says enrollment is up, there are more out-of-state applicants, and more job recruiters are coming to campus. That's all since the change. Soon it will be Augusta University's turn to see if a new name tells the best story. In Atlanta, I'm Bradley George for Marketplace.
Coming up.
This trade deal doesn't make up for all the offshoring that's happened over the last 20, 30 years. I'm the first one to acknowledge that.
Obama, part deux. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's up 13 points on this Tuesday, less than a 10%, ended at 16,790. Did the blue chips, the NASDAQ down 32 points, about 2/3%, 47.48. The S&P 500 gave up 7 points, about a 1/3%, finished at 1979. Ellen Coleman won the battle but lost the war. The DuPont CEO resigned only months after fighting off hedge funder Nelson Peltz. He wanted a seat on her board. A lot of investor funds agreed that DuPont shares should be higher, and after Coleman said she was out, shares up more than 7%. Tesla off nearly 2% today after Morgan Stanley said its new Model X SUV is too pricey. That is, unless you think an SUV is worth $120,000+, although I will say those doors are kind of cool. Celgene Corporation, moving into biotech and healthcare, makes cancer treatments off 3.8%. Epizyme, also cancer treatments, down 9.5% today. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year Treasury fell to 2.03%. And you, yes you, you're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. All right, back to that conference room at the Department of Agriculture and our chat with President Obama this morning. As he goes out on the road the next couple of months to sell the TPP to Congress and the American people, it's worth keeping our eye on the ball. What the deal is going to mean, not for the big companies and the multinationals, because they'll get a whole lot of the press, but what's it going to mean for you and me and for that thing that we have been talking about for months now on this program, how our own individual economies feel to us. Here you go. Let me ask you a question about individuals in this economy. We've been doing some economic polling. It's going to be out in a couple of weeks. What we are finding is a tremendous sense of people being stuck, of economic anxiety. Mm-hmm. And that's not to say that this is a jobless recovery, because as we know and as you know, jobs are coming back in this country.
Right.
What we have here, though, is a wageless recovery, because
yes,
they're going nowhere.
Yeah.
The question then is that the new normal? Should we just get used to that?
No, I think we shouldn't get used to it. And I think there's some very specific things we can do to finally start seeing more accelerated wage growth to match the job growth. Part of what's happened when it comes to wages as opposed to job creation is that as a consequence of globalization, but also because of automation and technology, increasingly workers have had less leverage. And so even if the jobs are being created, companies don't feel obliged to give people raises as demand for their products go up. They can say to themselves, you know what, we'll just invest in more automation instead of hiring more workers. Or if we do hire more workers, we'll tell them this is how much we can afford. And if we don't, if you want more, then we know that there's a bunch of other people that we can get. And we have to make sure that the middle class and workers have more leverage. And the laws that we set up in this country can make a difference. And here's what we know. There are countries like Germany where wages typically are higher, but they're still competitive. And it has to do with the arrangements they make and how big of the pie that's growing goes to middle-class families and workers as opposed to just shareholders and financial firms.
Last time we talked, I pushed you a little bit on how, you know, jobs inevitably, when trade agreements get done, they inevitably go away. And nobody who's in favor of free trade ever says, you know what, you're going to lose some jobs, get used to it. And you push back a little bit. Mm-hmm. Do you think people believe you when you say this will be good for us? Do you think my 17-year-old can believe you that in 20 years this is going to wind up being a net positive?
I think the starting point is skepticism when it comes to trade, because the story that people associate with trade, the story I associate with trade, I mean, remember, I'm a progressive Democrat who came out of a manufacturing state and saw plants close down in small towns and people who had worked there all their lives suddenly are left in the lurch. So I've seen the negative effects of trade. But the argument that I've made, and I make this especially to my union friends because they support me on everything else, but on this one we have a difference. What I've said to them is that companies in the United States who are pursuing a low-wage strategy and have decided that the way for us to compete and make a profit is to find the lowest wages possible, they've already left. They're already gone. And the question now becomes, how do we position ourselves so that we don't lose in the future? This trade deal doesn't make up for all the offshoring that's happened over the last 20, 30 years. I'm the first one to acknowledge that. But I can tell you that under my administration, manufacturing has grown faster than any time since the 1990s. And that's not just autos. That's across sectors. And part of the reason is because there are some things we've done to make ourselves more competitive. And we have also made sure that other countries are not taking advantage of us as much when it comes to the rules of the road. This is part of that overall strategy. You know, if you are fighting the last war, which typically happens in these debates where people say, well, look at what happened with NAFTA. Right. What I say to them is, well, we should have learned some lessons from NAFTA. And in fact, that's what we've done, which is why now we have enforceable environmental provisions and enforceable labor provisions. And as I said before, Vietnam is not going to suddenly have the same standards that we do. Malaysia's not going to suddenly enforce environmental provisions exactly the way we do. But we will have raised the bar for them. And if, in fact, they have these higher standards, which means that they have responsibilities and costs for operating in those countries that are higher than they currently are, then I'm confident we can compete. And we will continue to see insourcing of jobs moving here, moving back. What we can't do is think that somehow if we draw a moat around this country, that we're going to be able to avoid globalization and technology. Because, frankly, when you look at job loss and lost leverage, automation and technology has probably contributed more than trade has to that problem. And, you know, the anxieties are real. The concerns are real, but the prescription is not for us to try to look backwards. The prescription here is for us to look forward, and that's what this trade deal does.
Mr. President, thanks very much for your time, sir.
Great to talk to you, Kai. Thank you. Always a pleasure.
One more time, we've got the whole interview online, marketplace.org. A bunch of explainers about the TPP and my talk with the president last June. This final note on the way out today, the backstory, if you will, of what happens when the White House calls. You show up where they tell you to be, when they tell you to be there, and then you wait, and then you wait some more, and then it happens kind of all at once.
Kai.
Hey, sir.
Thanks for coming in, man.
Anytime.
Hold you know, you call, you sort of have to come, right?
I mean, not really.
Yeah, kind of, actually. I'm just saying.
Of course, you'll never get an interview again if
you don't.
Yeah, you do kind of have to come. That was the conversation I was having with my boss last night. As I said, the whole interview with the president today on our website, marketplace.org. Sort of a mixed bag in equities today. The Dow Industrials added 13 points, less than a tenth percent. NASDAQ down, though, 32 points, about two-thirds of 1%. The S&P 500 gave up 7 points, a third of 1% there. Caitlin Esch is the producer on our Wealth and Poverty Desk. Our digital producer is Tony Wagner. The senior digital producer is Nishad Kirwa. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.